Good morning, folks. I'd like to call the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Our first item of business is to approve the minutes. Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move their approval.
Discussion of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Nay. Motion carries. First order of business today, members, is I'd like to move House File 358 to be, let's see, we got to say this differently now. I'm going to move it to referred to somebody on the minority. Remember how they made you guys wanted to say it so we wouldn't get in trouble? Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I think we don't say it's recommended on anything. We just move it to the next committee.
Okay.
Without any recommend, we don't say anything about.
Okay.
We just say we move it to the next committee, if I remember correctly.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Poppy, thank you. I'd recommend, not recommend, that we pass it to Ways and Means. No, just kidding. Director Emke. First, members, maybe I could just explain the bill. For our area, it's the part of the deficiency bill that includes two items. The zoo is in the bill for $1.5 million, and the Department of Natural Resources is in the bill for $568,000. The zoo is 1.5 from the general fund. DNR will come from three funds, and basically it's broken down into the percentages from DNR that align with the work where it comes from. $69,000 from the general fund, $128,000 from the Natural Resources Fund, and $371,000 from the Game and Fish Fund. And when DNR comes forward, they'll explain what that's about. Director Emke, if you could identify yourself and your testifier could identify herself for the record and talk to us about the urgent need for $1.5 million. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Lee Emke. I'm the director and president of the Minnesota Zoo.
And I'm Mary Robinson. I'm the chief financial officer for the Minnesota Zoo.
Welcome.
Thank you. As we presented last week, we do have a shortfall in the current fiscal year. It looks like about $1.5 million based on our projections from the first quarter. And at this, at the current rate, our available cash will be depleted by early spring. So this is a matter of significant urgency for the zoo. And we're looking to this committee to recommend moving forward. It would be a significant investment for the zoo, relatively small in the big picture. It would make a huge difference to our budget. How did we get here? A question that's been asked. There are, were a number of questions asked in committee last week. And there are documents in your packages, I believe, that address a number of the specific questions about our fundraising history, about our strategic plan for moving forward, about our composition of our boards and the like. I would just refer that to you for your perusal at a later date. I know the chair would like us to get into the immediate issue quickly here. But that information is available, and we'd be happy to expand upon it at any time. The trends that have led to this current situation, number one, our general fund as a proportion of our total budget is at an all-time low. Currently, it's $5.425 million. That represents just 22% of the zoo's total operating budget. Significantly, in the past, we've been as high as 60% state general fund for our operating budget. And as a point of reference for zoos across the country, on average, 34% or a third of their operating budgets are covered by public funding. We're also seeing significant increases in expenses in all categories. Many of those are beyond our control. And given that we are now so dependent on our earned revenue stream, which do have some level of volatility, and in recent years we have not met our recent months have not met our projections, we are currently in the situation before you. We've been asked if we could increase the contributions to the zoo through the Minnesota Zoo Foundation. We are doing that. However, it only represents about 10% of our total operating budget, so even a significant increase in donations will have only a modest impact on our total budget. This slide shows you the overall trend of attendance at the zoo, and attendance is really critical for us because it means revenue. with 60% of our budget coming from earned revenue. Most of it is attendance-based. What you can see is an overall upward trend of about 20% growth since in the last 10 years. However, there is some up and down volatility, which comes from a number of factors, weather being one, other offerings in the Twin Cities, the general economic conditions, offerings that the zoo is able to provide, and therefore what look like relatively small changes in the overall attendance can have a big change in our operating budget. Again, earned revenue being key and attendance being key, that all comes back to our admission price. And we believe right now we are at a ceiling for admission pricing, both for, well, especially for the general admission. There is information about that that was requested last week as well that's in your package. So we don't think at this point we can either fundraise our way out of the deficit or increase pricing to do it. We do need significant additional state support. The timing was another thing that was a concern of members of the committee, and this has really been something that's been building for about 3 years. We've seen the cost pressures increase, especially on the compensation side for the zoo, for the last couple of years, and then compounded with that have been events like the polar vortex, the wettest spring in the history of Minnesota, and other things that have impacted our earned revenue. So it's the combination of those two things that have brought us to this position. And we were certainly aware of it going into the fiscal year, but became acutely aware of it at the end of our first quarter when we did not meet our attendance projections. And at that point, we began to put together our plan. The plan includes, it was speaking with folks at MMB and the governor's office and legislators to let everyone know that we would be coming forward with a deficiency request in this biennium. That said, we're also looking to be aggressive about increasing revenue despite the drop in attendance. As I mentioned, our foundation, which provides support to the zoo in a lot of ways, has agreed to increase their general operating support to the zoo from $2 million to $2.25 million this year, a significant bit of growth, in addition to committing to fundraising for capital projects, which will help us develop attendance in future years. We are always looking to drive attendance through new exhibits and new offerings at the zoo, and this year is no different. We will be reopening Discovery Bay with the Hawaiian monk seal exhibit this summer, and the foundation has raised money for a major nature-based play area that will also be opening up later in the summer. So we have some significant new offerings for the public coming up, mostly in next fiscal year. We're also looking to continue to look to the state as a partner with bonding for Heart of the Zoo 2, which is our next major exhibit project that we hope to have up and running within a couple of years. So those things will help drive attendance, which is our primary revenue driver. But in addition to that, we're looking at other sources of revenue from basically diversifying our revenue base. Last year, we built with private money and opened a new conservation carousel, which has generated about $100,000 a year in net profit to the zoo, which has helped with our operating budget. And we're looking at similar ventures both this year and in years going forward so that we continue to increase revenue, not just from the gate, but through other means as well. We've also been very cognizant of finding ways to reduce expenses over the last couple of years. Back in FY14, seeing the increased costs coming up, we realigned our budget, made a lot of expense cuts to accommodate the increases, particularly in the compensation area, and also to deal with the utility costs that we've seen go up, especially with the weather conditions we've had. As we came into FY15, we actually reduced our basic expense budget by almost $500,000 to accommodate, again, the increased costs from the prior year. And then after our poor first quarter this year, we made $500,000 in direct expense reductions, including 7 layoffs, which were obviously quite difficult to do, but it was necessary at the time. We're deferring site maintenance. We're reducing expenses that are not related to people as well. So we have the zoo staff, the zoo board have been very cognizant of the rising pressure of the costs as well as finding ways to reduce expenses over time. And I've been asked to address what would happen if we did not receive this deficiency request of $1.5 million. given that the majority of our costs at this point, near 70% of the zoo's expenses are in staffing, that is really the only place we can go. The other costs of the zoo are essentially fixed. We have to feed the animals, we have to heat buildings, we have to keep the public safety aspects at 100%. And so the only place we can look would be at staffing levels. And we estimated back after the end of the first quarter that in order to make up a $1.5 million deficit, we would very soon need to be looking at layoffs of very significant extent, maybe as many as 36, possibly even more, depending on the timing, which in turn would lead to us actually having to close exhibits at the zoo. The connection between staffing and maintaining exhibits is fairly obvious. Staff reductions of this level would require us to close significant portions of the zoo, which we believe would continue to have a deleterious effect on attendance and lead us into a lower level of earned revenue and probably be right back here in a year looking at another deficiency. We do not want to be there, clearly. If we are able to receive the request, we believe we can continue our track record as one of Minnesota's primary attractions and conservation destinations. Currently, a study was done by the University of Minnesota a couple of years ago that recognized that we generate about $146 million worth of economic benefit for the state of Minnesota. And if you go back to our current level of state funding, $5.4 million a year, that's a pretty significant return on investment. So getting this deficiency appropriation would allow us to continue that, continue to be that great return on investment for the citizens of Minnesota and continue to be one of the great resources for environmental education and conservation in our state. With that, I would be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Director Emke. Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Emke, thanks for providing those answers to some of the questions. I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, that I think would somewhat formalize benchmarking by the zoo so that for future legislatures there's some documentation of plans. We don't know what the governor's budget will say today, and we don't know what will happen at the end of session in terms of funding. I'm supportive of the deficiency request, and I think there's probably going to be bipartisan support for that. But whatever happens at the end, you may not get everything you want. So reporting back to the legislature, I don't think we want to be dealing with deficiencies every couple years, so we'd like some report, and I would move the A1 amendment.
Representative Hansen moves the A1. Members, I support the A1. I think it's a good idea for us to do that. Director Emke, comments on the A1?
Mr. Chair and members, we'd be supportive of doing that. I think some of the materials we provided are the beginning of exactly the kind of reporting you're looking for, and we would be pleased to provide that.
Thank you. Representative Dill, to the A1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. On line 1.4, it talks about December 2015. It would seem to me that with all the information that the zoo has given us, very articulately, I might add, they could have this work done before we end our biennial budget process at the end of session and inform the chairs of what they are going to do, as this amendment says, to ensure the long-term financial stability and success of the zoo. From what I hear from the testimony, there doesn't seem to be a lot of consternation on what it's going to take to get done. But if we wait until December 15th, we'll have already done our budget, and we won't be able to take into account any deficits that they might have or any surpluses they might have or how we would increase or decrease the appropriation in the up and coming biennium. So I'm putting out there, I'm not going to move it for a moment. I'd like to hear what other members have to say. It's changed that date to something along the lines of April 1st, something in there, so that we have that information before us. April 1st gives us a lot of time before May adjournment to figure out what that needs to look like in the long term. And so I just throw that out as an idea for us to just consider. It seems, as I said, I'll repeat one more time. They're very good at the zoo at getting us the information we want. So that would tell me that internally they know what they need. and so therefore they could come up with a plan a little more quickly than during the next biennium, where then we sit looking at a future debt deficiency bill, or we certainly could look at bonding to help with some of their projects during that period, because the bonding would be coming up the following spring. So I just throw that out as a point of discussion. I would move that amendment if that is what is necessary, but I'd like to hear some discussion on it before we take any formal action.
And Representative Deal, to your point, that would allow the director to lay out some scenarios based on levels of funding that may be included in our appropriation to the zoo. Representative Hansen, to the Deal conversation.
Mr. Chair and Representative Deal, I think that's a good idea for the plan, but also if we... It doesn't take into account what happens on adjournment, where they may have to react depending on how the legislature responds to what is done. I think I would ask the agency to provide something by April 1st, and maybe we don't need to do that in law, but it would be something. I think we need those recommendations, what if, to the chairs in both bodies, but we still, what happens on adjournment, they probably have to have that piece coming for the legislature, depending if they meet or exceed, if the legislature meets or exceeds their request. Are you following what I'm saying?
Representative Hansen, let's ask Ms. Taylor if she can come up with a suggestion how we could ask for like an interim report by April 1st of this year. Does anybody have any other questions as Ms. Taylor drafts that? Representative Fabian, is it this point? Otherwise, I think she's almost ready. Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this kind of to this point, I was going to ask about the effective date. You know, it's obviously it says in the bill final enactment. When do we anticipate final enactment, and how can we maybe do some of the things that Representative Dill is bringing up? So it's kind of all interrelated.
Representative Fabian, I would say this bill is clearly being fast-tracked. We waived the amendments for the 24 hours because it actually just got a bill number yesterday at 3 o'clock. So based on that and the way this is lining up, we need to do this ASAP. So I anticipate this bill is on the fast track. It's going to go to Ways and Means and to the floor, and hopefully the Senate is doing the same, because both of these are deficiency items that need to be dealt with. Representative Fabian. Okay. Ms. Taylor, are you just about ready? Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, what could be done is on line 1.7, after the period, insert, the board shall submit an interim report to the chairs and ranking minority members by April 1, 2015, period.
Representative Hansen, do you want to incorporate the Dill's suggestion and the way Ms. Taylor worded it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would incorporate that into the amendment.
Discussion to the amended A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A1's adopted. Director Emke, if I can ask you, unfortunately, you were on a downward trend there for the last couple of years and lost 5%, I believe, about each year. Am I saying that right? 5%. It was around 600,000 revenue was off, and then 600,000 more. Since that time, what's happened in the last few months?
Mr. Chair, our first quarter attendance was down 4% from the previous year and 7% from our goal. And the first quarter is always the most important one for the zoo. It's our busy season, the summer. Second quarter, however, has actually performed better than our revised goal. So we're cautiously optimistic about that, but I've got to caution that it's a much smaller portion of our overall attendance and therefore our overall budget. So again, some of the things we've put in place with marketing, you know, trying to get the word out about what's happening at the zoo and with membership does seem to be working, but I don't believe we're in a position yet to be to know what the risk would be beyond what we originally projected, which is the $1.5 million deficit.
Thank you, Director, and I appreciate that, and I wanted to confirm that we've had discussions in the last few days that this money is not to replenish your reserves, but if attendance would get back on a track that you had originally hoped for a couple years ago, you could be in a little better situation than anticipated. But if it would happen to be worse than what were the down times of the last couple years, it would go the other direction. So to that point, I think long-term in this body and this committee will be dealing with how to properly fund the Minnesota Zoo ongoing. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to make an oral amendment to this. I was looking through my papers, and I know that I had them before, and I don't think that the total that they were looking at was $1.5 million. I think it was a little less. And now with the attendance going up, they were talking about a new exhibit. I think that we could safely reduce this by about 10%. I'd like to make an amendment to reduce the $1.5 million by 10%.
Representative Green, so you're moving an oral amendment to change the 1.5 to 1,350,000.
Yes.
Discussions to the amendment. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would oppose the amendment and ask for roll call.
Okay. Members, additional discussion of the amendment. Members, I would support the amendment. I think it's prudent. They've done a little bit better in the last quarter. The reality is this is $150,000 in a approximately $50 million operation. $25 million is the annual budget, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's something that's realistic to handle. The zoo is very important to us, and we look forward to working with the zoo. Clerk will call the roll.
McNamara.
Aye.
Clark. Cornish.
Aye.
Dill.
Nay.
Fabian.
Aye.
Fenton.
Aye.
Fisher.
Nope.
Green.
Aye.
Hackbart.
Aye.
Hancock.
Aye.
Hansen.
No.
Houseman. Heintzman.
Aye.
Hornstein.
No.
Johnson.
Nay.
Neuberger.
Aye.
Purcell.
No.
Poppy.
No.
Rarick.
Aye.
Torkelson.
Aye.
Uglum.
Aye.
There being seven ayes, I'm sorry, seven. Twelve ayes and seven nays. The motion is adopted. The amendment, the oral amendment, is adopted. Director Emke, I think we're done with you unless you have additional questions for the director or Ms. Robinson. Thank you. Thank you for coming forward this morning. Next, Colonel Soaring, if you're here, and I believe Ms. Ulick is also here, who is the Chief Financial Officer for the DNR. If you could both identify yourself for the record, and Ms. Ulick, if I did that wrong, I wasn't sure how that J got pronounced. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, it's Barb Julek.
Julek, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Colonel Ken Soaring, the Division Director for DNR Enforcement.
Okay. Welcome, Director and Officer Julek. Thank you for being here. We've laid out just a little bit about what the total dollar amount is in your request. If you want to proceed, Colonel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for taking the time to hear this request. The Division of Enforcement's primary role is protecting natural resources and public safety on a statewide basis. We do that through law enforcement and education services. Over time, the capacity for us to fulfill that role on a statewide level has been diminished due to inflationary costs and increases. This specific request from the Division is to offset increases that were realized when the retirement system had some adjustments to it. Employer contribution was increased along with employee contribution and some other steps to manage that fund. So that increase is $255,000 in this current fiscal year. In addition, increases that we had to contract wage increases for both fiscal year 14 and 15, excuse me, created a $313,000 additional cost to our salary. Our division is funded primarily for delivery of law enforcement services. That's conservation officer salary, fleet, and operational costs. What I'm trying to manage with this request is to make sure that we don't add to our decreasing capacity to provide law enforcement services, resource protection, public safety, youth education programs. And so the total request over the 2 years is $568,000. And what this will equate to is filling conservation officer hours of service in this fiscal year. Without the increase, I'll be forced to make some hard decisions here if I don't get some funding to help with this of an additional 15,000 hours of service cut for the remainder of this fiscal year. Our conservation officers work on an annual work plan. We load hours into their work plan, which is tracked daily with their conservation officer daily reports, and that ensures both fund integrity, that we're providing the service delivery based on the funding sources that we have, and it also ensures that we're able to commit to the public those law enforcement services and respond to calls for service throughout the year through conservation officer normal patrol and response to seasonal trends, increases during the busy seasons like fall hunting seasons and spring fish run, fire season, that kind of activity. So again, this request would basically allow me to fund 15,000 hours of conservation officer service in this fiscal year. We're already experiencing a large reduction in conservation officer hours throughout the state due to vacant stations. So this request, again, will allow us to get through the remainder of this fiscal year and provide conservation officer services to the people of Minnesota.
Thank you, Colonel. Any questions for the Colonel? Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I've got a question on the fact sheet that was turned out, passed out. And on this, it talks, there's a bullet point, division funding tied to dedicated accounts, snowmobile, ATV, et cetera. Spending in these funds is limited to the lesser of the appropriation amount or the available funds from fees. And then the last sentence, resources available do not always match program needs. Could you tell me a little bit about what that means? And because I'm going to have some further questions, Colonel, I do support your the bill, and I do support the amount you're asking for, and that's not where I'm getting with this. But I do have some concerns about this statement. Could you explain that a little bit?
Director Sorin.
Yes. Representative Hackbarth and members. We do have occasional increases in work activity based on weather conditions, such as if there's a lot of snow statewide early on and throughout the year, the workload and calls for service may actually be higher than what our capacity is to work that many hours in a winter season. We normally try to adjust. Again, our officers have a tracking system where they can track how many hours they put in for their hourly goal for that fund. Occasionally, we do have, again, an example would be because of weather situations, we may have more snowmobile work than the funding actually would support throughout a full season. But we try to manage that to extend those services throughout that season. Sometimes those adjustments or increases in workload can be offset. If there's heavy snow, sometimes there may not be as much ATV activity during those times of the year, so we do have occasional imbalance in what the funding is, the source it comes from, and the workload that, that comes with it.
Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I'm understanding you right, it's not the funds that are available in the account, but it was the funds that have been appropriated to you already that you're dealing with, not the funds that are actually in the particular account.
Director Emke, I'm sorry. Yeah. We got two directors here. Director Sorn, did you want to answer that one?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, that's correct, that we spend only what is appropriated, not what's in the fund at the fund level.
Follow-up, Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll wrap this up, because I'm just concerned that there are some of these funds from some of the dedicated accounts. We talked about the Natural Resources Fund, but there's a number of different accounts in that account. And some of those accounts probably are paying a lot more than actually the benefits they're getting from those accounts. And that's why I was concerned about this statement, because it just didn't seem to match up.
Representative Hackbarth, did you want Ms. Julek to also weigh in on this, the number cruncher person, or are you good at the point you're at with Director Soaring answering your questions?
No, I'd like to have her weigh in as well, because my next question is, do we know exactly how this is going to break down? Do we know which dedicated accounts in the Natural Resources Fund, how that's broken out? I mean, how do we decide in this deficiency bill who pays what?
Ms. Julek.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the breakout is based on our current work plan and our historical hours in that work plan. I do have a summary of how it breaks out. We could pass that out if the committee would like.
Ms. Julek, do we not have those copies in our possession?
I don't know.
We don't. You have copies. Can the page get them from you? Thank you. Follow up, Representative Hackbarth.
No, that would be fine. That's all I need. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Colonel, if you could expand on your comment, you suggested that if we don't do this deficiency payment, that it would add to the decreasing capacity for the DNR to do its work in enforcement. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Colonel Soaring.
Mr. Chair and members, currently the division has 211 licensed officers at full capacity. Within that is 155 what we would call traditional conservation officer field officers that have a station. And over the what's happened throughout my career is as funding comes in and we get our appropriations, we provide a level of service at that funding, and we stay again within those appropriations, and occasionally inflationary costs don't keep up with the costs that we have in doing business, whether it's fleet, salary increases, other costs such as shared services. And so our capacity to fund conservation officers, we tend to manage that through vacant stations. Currently we have 29 vacancies in our licensed staff. Of the 23 field officers, or of the 155 conservation officers, we have 23 vacant field stations. And we're using the money from those vacancies to balance our budget. We have a new strategic plan that we're in the process of implementing here in the next, we'll start with this July fiscal year, trying to drive more of our available staff time down into the field service delivery part of the organization. We're doing that, again, to manage the workload that we have, the increased in season opportunities, and manage our not get into a deficiency again. At the beginning of this fiscal year, we had an anticipated $1.8 million deficiency, and through programming cuts, we've taken several steps. We postponed an academy. I think that's in the fact sheet. We're trying to manage that deficiency.
Follow up, Representative Johnson. Thank you. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so what I think that I'm thinking, reading between the lines, what Representative Hackbarth was talking about was funds, the different funds in the account get billed by the CO as he apportions his time. one of the funds that intrigues me is the off-road four-wheel drive account, where there's a lot, there's a couple, let's say $250,000 that's expended on enforcement, I believe, but there's only like 15 miles of trail. And so I'm wondering if that's how, why that's happening. You have to answer that now, but if you know, fine. But why is the, why is that so expensive to enforce that and cost so costly? And then the other thing I heard you say, and I mean, you're doing a fine job. I have, it's rare in this committee that I don't have some criticism of the conservation officers over something or another, and you know that. But you talked about goals, that in your goals, it almost made me feel, if I were a constituent, that if there was X amount appropriated for snowmobile enforcement, that it was a goal of the conservation officer to reach that so that the department got the money to pay out. And I think the constituents think it's the other way around, that we set an amount, and if you don't reach the goal, that's a better thing, only unless it's needed. And I mean, that goes back to the days when we had mandatory overtime. You know, the constituents are going, why are we paying mandatory overtime? Because it was their belief that people were going out and doing things just so they could collect the mandatory overtime. Whether that was true or not, I'm not making a judgment. But I think you kind of get where I'm going when you're a legislator or whether you're in the administration, how constituents do that. So could you shed some light on why the four-wheel drive people are paying so much? And if you can't answer that, that's fine. I'm sure you can answer in the future.
Colonel Sorry.
Yes, Representative Dillon, members, I'll answer that question as best I can. Our goals, maybe a better term is our work plan. So we look at the funding that we are appropriated, and to ensure fund integrity, I can't use dollars from Game and Fish to do enforcement in other arenas. So we make sure that fund integrity is there. The funding that comes in is based on our activity from the prior year. Generally, we look at what workload came in. Unfortunately, we don't have a records management system yet, but we're moving in that direction that will help us track calls for service and actually measure workload. We can have a little better transparency, I think, and better planning on where we spend our staff time. But right now, our work plans look at what we've done historically, the activity that's out there, and then based on our funding, we make sure that we provide that level of service to those users. Certain years, again, there may be a reduction in activity in cross-country skiing. We're not really funded for, but we do provide some enforcement of cross-country ski trails. And in a year like this, when the snow's not there, we will shift our activity to other recreational type of work that is activity.
Thank you, Colonel. Representative Dill, did you have any other follow-up? I got three other questions, and I would like to be done
go
by 9.
Ahead, Chairman. Go ahead. I do have a follow-up. But
go ahead, Representative Dill.
No, that's right.
You okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Soaring, recently I was doing a tour on my district, and I stopped at the Spring Steel Resort in Warroad. Some people would say that's a shameless plug, but whatever. And I happen to have a cup of coffee with three of the CEOs who were out doing patrol on the lake that day, and I appreciate the work that they do. You know, the boots on the ground are very important. So you know, I do support what we're doing here today, but I do have a couple of questions regarding some of the things that are on your fact sheet. One of the things that's on here is maintenance. I'm wondering if you have calculated, obviously the price of gas has come down significantly. How much has the price of gas, the decline in that, impacted the request that you're bringing to us today?
Ms. Ulick, do you want to tell how the department buys their gas and if you buy it on locked-in contracts or how that works? Ms. Ulick.
Mr. Chair, members, I will need to follow up on that specific question on how we buy the gas. But for the fleet cost, we have a fleet program, and divisions are billed for their usage of the fleet program. So based on the number of cars are maintained within that division, they are billed. The fleet bill includes usage for miles and gas, but it's also your maintenance, your insurance, and things like that. And only about 20% of the cost is tied to fuel. So there's a lot more within that that are tied to fuel. And those rates are set at the beginning of the year, and then will be adjusted based on actual cost.
Representative Fabian, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Colonel Soaring.
Well, Colonel, I'm sorry. Maybe if I could interject. The department has done a great job in the last decade of reducing their fleet numbers and costs. Mm-hmm. And if you want to interject something to Representative Fabian's point, but when Assistant Commissioner Meyer comes forward in your overall DNR budget, we will get further elaboration on fleet costs and such. But if you want to address specifically the CO's fleet costs, Director Soaring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just make one quick point that in managing this budget, again, we've made back about $1.3 million of the $1.8 shortage, and I'm looking at everything that I can do to find money right now. And I have looked at that and requested if there is any capacity to do that at this time. Our officers drive primarily diesel pickups, which drives our overall fleet rates down, and the fleet diesel prices have not reduced enough, I'm told, to make an adjustment at this time of year.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question, Colonel Soaring. When you have maintenance done on vehicles for COs, is that done in the local shops up there, the oil changes and so forth, at the local level in Rosa or Thief River Falls or wherever? Or how is maintenance done on vehicles?
Director Soaring, last summer when I was getting my oil changed on my way up north, I stopped at the Rapid Oil in Representative Heinzman's district and had a great conversation with one of the local DNR supervisor COs who happened to have his oil changed at the same time. Director Soaring.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Most of our conservation officers get their servicing done at a local vendor for oil changes. If officers are at the regional office, we have a shop in Grand Rapids, one in Metro. If we're at that facility for a meeting and it coincides with our oil changes, the local staff that work from that building may have their servicing done at a state shop, but 95% of those, I would guess, are done at a local vendor. It reduces travel time and cost for our agency.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I know Representative Hansen, he's not here, but he's always interested in outcomes. You talked about your funding and fund integrity and so forth and not being able to shift dollars around when you were answering some of Representative Dill's question. You know, as legislators, we're oftentimes interested in making sure that we have outcomes and performance. Do you have any idea how much you spend just trying to ensure that integrity? I mean, I know there's a cost involved in accounting those things.
Mr. Chair,
Colonel, sorry.
I'm not sure I can put a dollar value on what that program is. Right now we're using what's called a DEERS, a daily enforcement. It's an electronic system. So once we load our work goals, our work plans into that system for the year, which is maybe a couple of days of staff time to do. Beyond that, it's an electronic tracking system. And then we do manage quarterly. Our officers and lieutenants will actually look monthly to see that there's not a deficiency in one activity. So there's some supervision time to make sure that we reach those goals, but for the most part, it's done electronically through the reporting system that we have.
Additional follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, Colonel Soaring, on your handout in the bottom left corner in the paragraph that's there, it says, if we continue down this path without additional resources, there's significant potential for reduction in voluntary compliance for resource protection. Explain to me what voluntary compliance would be.
Colonel Soaring.
Mr. Chair and members, the goal of enforcement is to protect the resources that we have for the citizens of Minnesota, and we do that through getting voluntary compliance with regulations such as season limits, purchasing a license, which helps fund the management programs that we have. So through outreach and education, our goal is not to catch people in violations. Our goal is to get voluntary compliance up front, and that's I think most attainable through having regulations that are supportable and well understood, making sure that the user is aware of their requirements, and then there's always a law enforcement need to ensure that people are making those right decisions and that we have sustainable harvest.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then, just to that point, I've had conversations with Assistant Commissioner Meyer and others over the years. The Game and Fish rule book that we get is, I believe, 128 pages, and you talked about making sure they're understood. I'm not sure that that's always the case for a lot of people who are really trying hard to make sure that they abide by the rules, and I hope that you just take that into consideration as you're going about your job. Thank you for the good work you do.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, just a real quick comment on the enforcement budget. It's a moving target. I think we brought it on somewhat ourselves, and then the Budget Oversight Committee, remember a few years back, the Budget Oversight Committee noticed that the accounts weren't matching up with the hours, and some of them complained that their area of activity, either a small game or a large game, wasn't getting the attention it needed, and more was going into others, and some of their money was being spent in other accounts, so we kind of clamped down. And just little things like the cost of gas, where we would think it would save money, it also causes a lot more people to go on tourism and head up north, and more of them to use their ATVs and their snowmobiles, and therefore more work hours for the COs. So it's really hard to nail down a budget, or you might have a big spring fish run, or you get a real wet spring where there's no fire danger, and then you don't have the patrol for the fire hours. So the whole budget is just a moving target. Then you spend a certain amount of money one year, and the next year you don't have any snow, and here the previous year you had all this, so it's hard to plan from year to year. So I'm just trying to give you some idea of what then how difficult the enforcement budget with all the regulations and different accounts they have is to manage. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Last question, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, I just first of all want to thank you for the job that you do. I haven't had an opportunity to thank the DNR officers for the job that they did at the Green Valley Fire a couple of years ago up by Park Rapids, and that was excellent work. I just want to speak in favor of this. It's a relatively small amount from the general fund, otherwise we're moving money around. I think that in the long run this is going to save the state money. We're not hiring any new people, as I understand. This is just to increase the hours of the officers that are already out there. So I hope that we can move this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Green. Seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion to pass House File 358 as amended to Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Bill is passed and moving on to Ways and Means. Thank you, Colonel. Thank you, Chief Financial Officer Julek. Appreciate it. Assistant Commissioner Meyer, thank you for coming forward today. Next, members, first I would like to ask Ian Cunningham, who is the president of the Minnesota Association of Soil Water Conservation Districts, and Director Jaski, you might as well just come right down also. And then President Cunningham, if you could just tell us a little bit, if I'm not mistaken, your day on the Hill, and you had a meeting last night. If you could tell us a little bit about what your group does, and we welcome you to the committee. President Cunningham. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Ian Cunningham. I'm president of the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and I earn my living on a fifth-generation family farm in southwest Minnesota. I also serve as a locally elected board member for the Pipestone Soil and Water Conservation District. Today is our SWCD Day at the Capitol, and our members are meeting with legislators to communicate local conservation activities and outcomes. And several of our members are present in the gallery. Our association represents Minnesota's Soil and Water Conservation Districts, also known as SWCDs, and the 445 men and women who have been elected to serve on their governing boards. SWCDs are local units of government established under state law to carry out natural resource management programs. Districts work with cooperating landowners and operators to help them manage and protect land and water resources on all private lands. The function of a soil and water conservation district is to take available technical, financial, and educational resources, whatever their source, and focus or coordinate them so that they meet the needs of the local land user for the conservation of soil, water, and related resources. Districts work closely with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, as well as federal, state, and local partners to implement conservation activities. Thank you for your past support of SWCDs, and we look forward to working with you to address the SWCD funding needs for the restoration and protection of our natural resources.
Thank you, President Cunningham. I appreciate you being here today and the good work that you folks do. Questions for Mr. Cunningham?
Thank you for your
time. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Members, we'll go back to the presentation by Bowser, and you should have in your save folder the presentation that Director Jasky was working on. Director Jasky, welcome back. If you could identify yourself for the record and continue on with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Jasky, Board of Water and Soil Resources Executive Director, and I'm going to pick this up where we left it off at the last meeting and try and get through a few of the slides that cover sort of some of the history and the, on the budget and the programs that are associated with that, and get into some of the more forward-looking points that I'd like to make in our agency overview. The last point that we finished up with was that our budget, our funding, the vast majority of it goes out to local governments for the projects and the work that they do on the ground. And so that's the way our delivery model is set up. We use those local staff, those local officials to get the work done. And so that's the reason our budget is set up such that it's most of our funding is passed through to those local organizations. They also, you heard President Cunningham describe what the Soil and Water Districts do. They also work with, and we do as well, a number of non-government organizations, conservation groups. We have agreements with Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Land Trust. I'm going to miss several there, but we work with a lot of private organizations, as do the local officials and local staff in those watersheds and counties. I'm going to cover a few things that are in each of our budget categories and not go into a lot of detail. We'll have a chance to do that in future hearings, I'm sure. One of the things that's in our budget category is the protection of resources through existing rules and laws. We have oversight of the Wetland Conservation Act, which is the state's law that protects wetlands from draining and filling. We have responsibilities to oversee the drainage law that's carried out by local drainage authorities, that's counties and watershed districts. And the state, through our Natural Resources Block Grant Program, provides funding to county organizations or county governments, and then they pass that on to other organizations in some cases. For water management, shoreland management, the county feedlot programs, and SSPS programs. These are programs that are overseen by other agencies as well as ours, and so we bundle those funds into a block grant, which gives the local officials the best way to package the resources that they have from the state to get the job done in their county.
Excuse me, Director. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jasky, could you describe Bowser's role in buffer management or enforcement?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portland, could I defer that to a few slides to come? I think about a few ideas that I could help answer your question with the slides that I've got in my presentation.
That'll be just fine. Thank you.
Director Jasky.
Continue on then. And here you can see the funding for this budget category historically going back to several biennium. And these, as you can see, the trend is downward. And you've heard that from the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and from the counties. They're the recipients of these funds, and so they will let you know that, and they've demonstrated this, that the state's contribution has decreased over the last decade. We also have some funding for operations within the agency for these two programs, wetlands and drainage, and those numbers are have gone on slightly as well. The state has the authority and responsibility to establish these local special purpose districts, soil and water conservation districts, and watershed districts, as well as oversee the county water management authorities. One of the things that we're moving towards is more of a watershed approach to use the science. Those plans now number 200 and some, and our goal is over the course of the next 5 to 10 years to get that down to somewhere in the
range of 65 or so, because we will have fewer plans and much more work focused on doing the projects those plans are prescribing rather than being in a perpetual state of planning. And I'll cover that again in a little bit later slide. The current plans, the current programs, I'm sorry, that describe these plans, they really fall into these three categories. We have funding that goes directly to the soil and water conservation districts for some of their base work, but that number has, of course, dwindled over the years, and they've been around here yesterday and today talking about that. I mentioned the One Watershed, One Plan idea that we're moving towards to reduce the number of plans and focus much more on the actions necessary to improve our water and soil conservation work. We have pass-through grants that go to a couple of specific organizations. The Red River Basin Commission is a interstate international organization that includes representation from Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Manitoba to deal with a lot of the issues surrounding both water quality, flooding, and other water-related issues that are in the Red River Basin on all in all those states and in the province. That money goes to this organization that's headquartered currently in Fargo, but each of the states and the province put money into that organization. This comes through our agency. There is an organization in southwestern Minnesota that is set up to do flood control coming off the Prairie Coteau on the south side of the Minnesota River. They get funding for their operations through a grant from Bowser. And you'll see this coming up. The Minnesota River Joint Powers Board used to get funding. They used to actually exist, but they no longer do. So they do not get any funding, of course. They had a joint powers established between counties beginning in the 1990s, and last year they disbanded. And so there's a bit of a void there about, you know, how that Minnesota River Basin is going to be managed going forward. I think there's certainly lots of potential there to use the local governments that already exist, the counties and so on, water districts, to do a lot of this work, but that is a change from the previous biennium. Here's just the numbers on those funds, the conservation delivery grants that go to the soil and water districts. You can see that number has gone down in actual dollars over the last biennium. The others have been, you know, relatively consistent or slightly down. The Minn River Board, of course, is zeroed out last year because they disbanded. The heart of this is really getting work done on the ground, getting projects accomplished all across the state in urban areas, rural areas, you know, wherever the needs are. These grants go to the local districts that you heard Mr. Cunningham talk about. There's a category for different types of work in those grants, subcategories. Erosion control is a very large one. A native buffer program, we'll talk more about that as well. Feedlots, cooperative weed management, these are sub-programs that have been identified in with rider language over the years. Sometimes they're specifically called out, and sometimes they're lumped.
Excuse me, Director. Representative Heinzman.
Mr. Chair, Director Jansky, I tried to get my question earlier. I missed my chance. We're going to have to go back a couple of slides here. Back to the one watershed, one plan. Mm-hmm. What is the reason, what is the thought behind taking the agency that direction?
Director Jansky.
Yeah. Mr. Minn, Representative, I'm going to come up with a little bit more detail on that, but the idea overall is that we have water flowing across geopolitical boundaries, obviously, across county boundaries, across city boundaries. We have organizations set up to manage water on those boundaries, and we need to keep that, but we have to find a way to work a plan across those geopolitical boundaries is the simplest way to say it, and have those organizations work together on that. And we've been working over the last 3 or 4 years based on some legislation that Representative Perkelson helped get passed or led and got passed, was that 3 years ago? I think it was about that, to make that possible. Prior to that, it really wasn't possible. So now that it's possible, it's a matter of carrying it forward and getting that to be undertaken across the state systematically over the next 5 to 10 years.
Representative Heinzman.
Yep, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jansky. As we're moving towards that plan, the One Watershed, One Plan, will there still be the flexibility for individual watershed districts to maybe opt out of that, not participate? Will they still have the flexibility to do what they need to do in their district? You know, maybe maybe it might not fall in line with the one watershed, one plan, but it's unique to their district.
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the short answer, I think, is yes. Each of the watershed districts will have their own plan to set their own, you know, course, to justify their own work and to make sure that they're covering their priorities, their communities that are a priority. And it's really a question of scale. You know, I think we will have these one watershed, one plan work being done at a, we call it a major watershed, you know, Redwood River, Pine River, you know, Red Lake River, that kind of scale. And some of the watershed districts have got much more specificity to their work, and that will continue.
Representative Heinzman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaski. I guess what I'm referring to and trying to boil down to is there's definitely some things in there that individual watershed districts have expressed some concern, maybe privately, maybe not to Bowser, that they might not find agreeable to their situation. So is that going to be something that's pressured on them in any context? Or will they still have the freedom to do what they need to do in their district?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the watershed district plans currently require state approval and local adoption that will remain. So there's some state influence over those, and certainly there's some connection to future funding that would be part of that. But they will, under the current law and any proposed laws that I'm aware of, retain all of the authority that they currently have. That's true for watershed districts, counties, and soil and water conservation districts.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jaski, you briefly mentioned the dissolution of the Minnesota River Joint Powers Board. And are there any other river basins that have a similar joint powers board?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, the answer is not exactly the same. The Minnesota River Joint Powers Board was a joint powers organization of counties across that, I think it was 37 counties, if I'm remembering correctly, across the entire Minnesota River drainage area. The Red River Basin has a joint powers of watershed districts that's formed in that part of the state. So they have watershed districts that have joined together across the basin to manage it in a coordinated fashion. And they have some special authorities to do that in statute.
Follow-up, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you suggesting that the Minnesota River do something different, or are you just kind of waiting to see what happens?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, at this point I'm not suggesting that we do anything different. I do believe that the One Watershed, One Plan approach can be very helpful. What more needs to be done remains to be seen. There are current authorities in law to do much of what that organization was, you know, could have done. I guess they didn't, in my opinion, not do an awful lot over that 15 or 18 years that they existed. So I think there's opportunity to do more, and I think we need to do more on that basis. And the question is how to structure it, and there's existing ways to do it in the current law, and I suppose we'll see if any other ideas come forward as legislative proposals.
Continue, Director Jaski.
Now back to this, but the budget again, you know, this is the dollars that are available to do the projects on the ground of soil and water conservation districts, and you can see that, you know, that number has dropped in half over the last, 8 to 10 years. Another area of work that we do in the budget is to accomplish permanent protection via conservation easements, really focused on use of our Reinvest in Minnesota program, or RIM, to acquire land via conservation easements to restore wetlands, to protect sensitive areas along, in this example, wild rice areas in north central Minnesota. We've got a program that deals with land acquisition along riparian corridors, along streams and rivers and ditches, and I'll come back to that. Representative Torkelson asked about it. We also have a program that we work with the Minnesota Army National Guard and the Department of Defense to acquire conservation easements around the Camp Ripley military installation in central Minnesota to preserve the conservation benefits, but also to preserve the ability for that facility to carry out its mission for the long term, so that we don't have development or incompatible uses encroaching on the perimeter of that facility. And then we have responsibility, once those easements are in place, to do the work of monitoring and enforcing the conditions of those easements. Most of that work is done by the local soil and water conservation districts, so, you know, they're close by, they can check on these things, they can talk to landowners. It's very, very efficient to do that, and we need to make sure that continues. And here's just a picture of some of the easements. It's hard to see all these dots, but
A lot of these were developed over the last 26 years the program's been in existence. A big area was focused in southwestern Minnesota with well and restorations, and over the past couple of decades, and I'm sure that's going to continue. But we've also seen, as you can see in very central Minnesota there in Morrison and Crow Wing County, that little circle around Camp Ripley is beginning to reveal itself even on a statewide map with a number of easements that have been taken around that military installation. And then we, of course, have the costs of agency administration and operations. Training is a very big part of what we do. We spend, make it a priority to provide quality training opportunities for local governments. We have an academy we run each fall. We have, 400 or more local staff come to that academy and get the training in one centralized location. And it's a good opportunity for them to learn from each other as well. We also do field training for staff to learn how to do the technical work that it takes to make good decisions and help provide landowners with good advice and design standards. This is a list of those things, which you all, I'm sure, know about already. And that number, of course, has similarly dropped over the last, 8 to 10 years. And so there's this trend that you'll see across all of these categories of a reduction in the budget that we've been able to secure for these purposes. This shows all of those various components in the budget rolled up into, one number, and you can see the trend over the last 10 years is down. These are in actual dollars, so if you factor in inflation, it also takes that down another notch, because those costs that we incur, as well as local governments incur, have those inflationary things that have to be otherwise absorbed, and that's making that number even more dramatic. So what I want to do is, if I have any more questions about budget that or programming,
Director Jaski, yes. Did you miss a slide?
I'm sorry if I did.
Did you mention that slide, or did I miss it?
Sure, I can mention it again. It's just, this shows the general fund, all of the general fund that comes to our agency and is passed to local governments that has, these are actual dollars beginning with 2004-5 biennium, and then the arrow at the very end of this indicates what that dollar amount would be in real dollars if you factored in inflationary increase.
Thank you, Director. I missed that. I apologize. Sorry.
So it's, if you factor in inflation, it's about half of what was provided in, a biennium or 10 years ago. Any other questions about the budget or the programs that are part of that? Otherwise, I'll move on to some of the future issues and go into some of the questions that came up earlier.
Thank you. Continue, Director.
So here's a sample list of a number of, issues and plans to address those issues, and the basis for how these issues that we're facing today, have come to be understood. I'm not going to go into all of these. These are something you can, of course, refer to on your own. But, the top center of this, there's a recent report this past year by the MPCA about this need to do more to reduce nutrients reaching our surface waters. We have groundwater issues, too, but this report focused on surface waters. We've done some work on our own to look at the way that the current soil loss laws are used or are inadequately in some cases useful, I guess, for some of the strategies that are talked about in that document. The Prairie Conservation Plan has been around for a few years now, and we've been using that as well as other agencies to target land that is, by and large, the least useful for production purposes, but the most beneficial for conservation purposes in that prairie landscape. That was done with the DNR along with a number of NGOs that helped pull that together, and it's been very helpful to help our staff in the field out this target land and landowners who may have some opportunity to do more on their property for public benefit, of course, through these voluntary conservation programs, and some land acquisition that's being done through other agencies. The Clean Water Roadmap up in the upper left is something that the agency's worked on over the past year and a half to try and put in place some longer-term goals, really focused on the legacy amendment and what we can expect to accomplish in water quality improvements over the next 20 years. I encourage you to take a look at that. There's some fairly specific goals, not all of them, but a sample set that describes what we can expect to do in various parts of the state to improve water quality. And the water sustainability framework laid out both some of the issues and some ideas of how to deal with those, you know, a few years ago, and that's still something that we are paying attention to and looking at for ideas. So I'm going to show you a few pictures here that, you know, just show some problems, and that doesn't mean that, you know, this is implicating anyone or any place, but, yeah, Mr. Chairman. Hey,
Director Jasky, I'm going to ask you to make it a goal to be through all the slides, and I'm actually going to let you walk through them all and wrap up by about 10 to 10, so then we'll have folks keep their questions. You can raise your hand if you have questions. I'll put you on the list. But I'd like you to wrap up, say, in the next 20 minutes or so, if you can walk through all the slides, because we would like you to be done today.
I'm going
to
do that. Director Jasky. And I will be happy to follow up with any member who's got a question about any of these, you know, after the fact, and I will try and hit on some of those that were asked already. So here's a real-world place, and what we see here is, you know, is a problem, and dealing with these problems takes a, you know, multitude of approaches. You know, two of the things that Minnesota has that we're going to have for a very, very long time, you know, decades, centuries, and millennium, is going to be our fresh water and our soil are probably those two variables come together in Minnesota better than any place in this world. We have the most productive soil and we have the most fresh water, and those are going to be two assets that we're going to have to make sure we take care of, you know, for a very, very long time, because the rest of the world is going to see that we've got it and they're going to want some of it or want to use some of it. So we got to take care of it. And this is a place where, you know, the care is not being taken. Now, there's a sediment problem here. There's ways to deal with it, but the people who are downstream of this, whether it's the people who share a ditch or a river or somebody further downstream, know that this is not sustainable, that this land has got problems that need to be corrected. And we've got ways to correct that, but we have to have some landowner, in this case, or the operator, work with us to do that. And the soil and water districts are well equipped to prevent this as well as fix it if that's what it takes.
Director Jasky, if you could just, who would be the person on the ground, for instance, that would most likely go to the property owner and have a conversation with them? Who, a state, local employee? Who would it be?
Mr. Chairman, you know, the best place to start and for problems like this and some others is the Soil and Water Conservation District, in my opinion. There may be others that could help, that maybe federal help that's available or state help, but that's the starting point in my mind, is to go to that person. They will know who the landowner is, or at least I'll find a way to contact them. They will have technical expertise that they could bring to advise. They have potentially financial resources to help.
Thank you.
Here's another problem. This is a wind erosion problem. You know, again, similar, you know, results, which is we've got a piece of property that needs some attention. It's causing harm to their neighbors. It's causing harm to the public. You know, and certainly if this landowner or the operator knew that this is a problem that was going to occur, would have hopefully been able to do something to prevent it in the first place. These are problems that are easily remedied and prevented if we know how to do it and we have resources to do it ahead of time. Here's a non-buffer area. You know, my inclination is to walk up to this person and go, what's going on here? You know, why are you doing this? I didn't do that here, but I took this one myself in southern Minnesota. You know, and you wonder if it's because they don't know, which as I hope that it is, or if it's something else. But this is a example of where we have, you know, a non-buffer causing, you know, concern to people downstream, both nutrients and sediments. So we've got to figure out some way to work on this, and we have to deal with it. But they may not be big enough, or may not be all the options that we currently have to get the solution to this site. We also have, you know, problems that are derived from, you know, more urban areas. You know, we have a lot of impervious surfaces, you know, parking lots and malls and roofs and roads. That's just the way things were built, you know, 50, 80, 100 years ago. And, you know, here's a parking lot right in the Mississippi River. This is, you know, St. Cloud State University. You know, this parking lot was built way, way long ago on top of some sandy soil that used to infiltrate right into the river. Now it just goes in a pipe to the river because there's no place to really do much other than get the water out the parking lot. And, of course, some of the things that the cars leave behind gets going along with it. You know, cities, St. Cloud and for sure, and others are responsible for improving their stormwater management over time through what's known as MS4 requirements, but those come into play typically as redevelopment occurs, and they have some responsibility to make sure this parking lot is swept and cleaned to the best of their ability. But the infrastructure is right on the river, and that's where it was built, and that's where it's going to probably stay. But we can do things to retrofit to make it better. Some of these damages are not, you know, just because someone wasn't paying attention carefully enough or doing the right thing. We do have disaster-type occurrences that are going to happen. We have major storms that are sometimes getting bigger and more frequent. They cause erosion. They cause property damage. We've got ways to deal with that as well, preferably in a preventive mode because it's much, much cheaper. I was reminded of a project just up in, or I'm sorry, in Two Harbors. We had a big flood up there, you know, a few years ago, and there was a project that was built in Two Harbors that was upstream of a big car dealership and a cemetery, and it was a $300,000 project, and the city engineer said if we hadn't spent that money there, that it would have been, you know, $3 million worth of damage downstream because it would have washed the cemetery out, would have washed the car dealership out. So there are designs that are available and resources to some extent available that prevent these things as well. And, you know, a problem that didn't occur is one that doesn't get any pictures taken of it, but that's the way we spend our money most wisely. Soil health, this is one of the, I think, emerging areas that we can find some common ground with production, in this case agriculture and conservation. You know, the ability to increase our soils like organic matter not only gives us better productivity, but I think this is the correct statistic that if you increase the soil type, and this is on an average soil because they're all a little bit different, by 1% organic matter, you get another inch of water holding capacity in the soil itself. So you don't have to build a retention area. You don't have to, you know, hold back the water because the soil itself will do that. Now, we actually, with drain tile and those sorts of you know, installations taking place, we have more predictability to allow this soil to be grown and have more organic matter and still get consistent drainage. And so I think if there's one, you know, positive thing that can come out of that is that we should be able to do more on the soil health, the organic content, to get better production and more conservation. Buffers. Representative Ferguson talked about this, so I want to make sure I cover it. You know, buffers are a very effective a practice that has been around for many, many years. We've known this since probably the 30s, that you put something next to the water that's going to filter it, and it's going to help. It filters it because the root mass, you know, absorbs nutrients. It helps because the root mass holds the soil together so the banks don't collapse. And in this case, you know, we've got a species mix in the upper left there that has, you know, a number of forbs and things, so you get some of the habitat benefits that we know are also important in those riparian zones. And these buffers are, you know, lake shores, rivers, streams, ditches. The lower left is a picture of a two-stage ditch where you really build some of the buffering into the ditch channel itself so that the ditch, the water moves around in the ditch. The buffers are both inside the ditch, the vegetation, and on the bank. And this is accomplishing a good bit of benefit within a fairly narrow footprint. The ditch channel is pretty much what it was. A redesign allows it to meander on purpose. It provides water attenuation. It slows the water down from getting downstream. It filters it, and it provides, you know, a little bit of on the periphery, some habitat. And we all know about the lake shore. You know that the most productive part of a lake is the part, you know, between the land and the water, for all the amphibians and macroinvertebrates and so forth, and even, of course, fish spawning. I think all of you know a lot about that already. Some numbers. This is in a recent assessment that we made of what the parts of the state where we have egg production. These are the numbers that we're able to come up with for where we have buffers that are required and where we have areas that have no requirement. There's two current standards in existing authority. The first is the shoreline requirement, which is under a local zoning ordinance. Our best estimate is that about 30% of the water courses in that part of the state require this 50-foot buffer for the local zoning ordinance. Our estimate is that about 6% of the ditch miles in that part of the state require a buffer.
of one rod, or 16 and a half feet. That's because the ditch law doesn't trigger a buffer requirement until they go through something called a redetermination of benefits, which is to reassess the benefited parties, you know, to pay for that buffer, and that isn't triggered until a couple of different things occur. County ditch authorities or watershed authorities can trigger that on their own, but they typically have to wait for a petition to go down that avenue. And then the remainder, there's a lot of waters that don't have a buffer requirement because they are in neither a shoreline status or are they a public ditch system. So this is our best estimate for the part of the state where we have most of the agricultural land. Does not take into account any lakeshore or wetlands or anything like that. Those are other numbers that we'd have to come up with. So be happy to talk about this more, I'm sure, at a future hearing if you want to focus on this. Buffers, you know, we know they work. I mean, that's the science. You know, the question is, you know, how do we get more of them? As been mentioned before, you know, we have a number of voluntary programs to help with that. The federal agencies, particularly USDA, NRCS, and FSA, have resources available to enroll in CRP contracts. We've had in the past some money for buffers through contracts. We've used our Reinvest in Minnesota program to enroll easements, and we've had much, much greater demand than we've had resources available. We have the soil and water districts and watershed districts and the counties, too, to some extent, although the soil and water districts and watershed districts are the ones that have the technical expertise. They can help landowners do this. We've got half a dozen counties that have done this systematically already or undertaking it. We gave an award, actually, to Otter Tail County, who is undertaking this, and they're on a 9-year plan. They've got a very large amount of water in their county, rivers, streams, and lakes, and so they're working very carefully with their soil and water conservation district to give people the opportunity to enroll in a program to get technical assistance to just do it themselves. Half the landowners just say, you know, I don't want to be involved in some program. I just want to, you know, comply, and can you give me some advice and help about how to do it so I do it right, so I don't, you know, I don't do it wrong the first time I have to redo it. So there's a number of those examples we could come back to you, Mr. Chairman, members, and talk with you about how that's working other places and what else might be needed. I'll move on to the Wetland Conservation Act. This is a law that's been around since 1991. It was passed to really provide the protection to existing wetlands. It's a statewide law. It's administered, you know, through local governments, as all of our programs are. We are the agency that oversees it and develops the rules and the programming and the training for it. We have certified delineators who help in the private sector as well as the local governments figure out where the wetland boundaries are and help landowners work through that process. The DNR has some enforcement responsibilities that they use in coordination with local governments. Colonel Soaring and his staff provide that peace officer, licensed peace officer enforcement when that's needed, and we also make sure we're working as carefully as we can with our federal agencies, the Corps of Engineers and the USDA NRCS on their programming related to wetland protection. Currently, you know, one of the issues that we're focusing on is how to make sure we get the best wetland mitigation possible. The law, all these laws require that you first avoid impacts to wetlands, and then if you can't avoid them, you offset them by replacing one someplace else. The map on your left shows these what we call wetland bank service areas where you can, you know, that's the sort of the area you look for wetland mitigation credits. Minnesota's had a wetland banking program for a very long time now, and it's been very successful. Northeastern Minnesota is one of the places where we have the biggest challenge because abundance of wetlands and very few opportunities to find one where one was lost and can be put back. Drainage, we have responsibility to oversee the public drainage law to the extent that the state has a role in it. We are working on a drainage manual update, a very important document that is used by all these local authorities. We also facilitate this work group at standing, named in statute, and we also have a number of cost share programs that can work with producers and ditch authorities to do additional installations to hold more water and treat more water that enters these public and private drainage systems. Disaster recovery, you know, we've had
I think in the last 7 years, five FEMA disasters related to flooding in this state. This happens to be an example from southeastern Minnesota. This is Minnesota City, Garvin Brook. This, you can see in the upper right, these homes and property were threatened after this flood came through, and fortunately no one in this area was harmed or injured or passed away. But we needed to do something very quickly to get this bank stabilized so their property wasn't going to be in danger, you know, through the fall and winter. And we worked with the federal government to get the resources and design in place to get something started there. This is one that involves a lot of rock. Sometimes you got to use rock. Sometimes you can use plants. Sometimes you can use both. But, you know, you weren't going to put in, you know, just plants here in the late summer and hope that it was going to hold. We need to get rock in there to preserve this. This is an outside of a very, you know, high-moving stream system. And so that's going to save that project. Is now, if you go down there, it's, you know, it's got vegetation on it and so forth, too, and those homes are well-protected, and the stream has restored itself to some extent. We've got some damages that, you know, were addressed in this last disaster, and there was legislation, I think, that the House just passed, like, last week to get some more funding to match the federal resources that are available. I know that some have said there's still more to do, and we'll have to wait and see what that looks like. Climate change, you know, we really do two things. I mean, the two things we do and the two things that local governments are doing is we're moving more towards using native plants so that they can adapt to climate change, you know, when it happens or how it happens, and we're using different design standards for our engineering to make sure that we predict rainfall events that are coming more regular and higher velocity or higher volume, and so upgrading our design standards for our engineering. Pollinators, everyone knows this is a big issue to make sure that we have the ability to have our plants that require pollinators be healthy. We've got a website that has integrated all the current knowledge and work for local governments to use when they're doing their designs in their own watersheds, their own counties. This has, I think, been a multi-agency effort, and I know that education is a huge part of it, but we've also seen components built into programming as well for easements and other things that we do. Habitat protection, largely coming from the Outdoor Heritage Council funding, and I know that you'll be hearing what their bill is tomorrow, so I'll pass on that one rather quickly. I was asked about the watershed approach and the idea of moving to this one watershed, one plan. The idea here is that we've got a lot of different studies that we've built over the last decade or so, monitoring all the science is watershed based. And I have to give kudos to the MPCA for changing the way that they were dealing with this to a much more useful approach for Minnesota. The EPA said we got to do some things, and they were going for doing that, but they went above and beyond and have adopted a proposal, or not a proposal, but an approach that allows us to use that work for much more than otherwise would be required by EPA. And I think that's been something that has stimulated this one watershed, one plan endeavor. We are using that science to make a good plan that everyone can agree on and then focus on the action to follow. So it's the science, the plan, and then the action. A little bit about scale. You know, these reports that I alluded to earlier identify some goals for water quality improvement across the entire state. And even though we spend, you know, a significant amount of money in any given year trying to help accomplish those goals or get towards those goals, you know, year by year, you know, it doesn't look like much. And so these bar charts just show you, you know, that, you know, any one year isn't, you know, making a huge dent. It's going to be constant progress ramping up over time that's going to get us to these long-term goals. And I believe in the case of nitrogen in particular, we're going to have some technology that will help us do that too. So that's, you know, still being worked on by the universities, and we hope to be able to see that, you know, put into practice in the near future. Again, the scale issue, I mean, you know, the St. Croix River, you know, large river system that drains into the metropolitan area eventually, or at least on the eastern side. You know, the work that we've been doing there over the last year, you know, really accounts towards us getting just 1% of the way towards the goal that they might have in that watershed plan. But if you look at a smaller scale, Comfort Lake, up in the Forest Lake area, you know, one project has got us 41% of the way towards the goal that lake had for its water quality improvement. So you know, we have to keep in mind that the scale of these of this work is really important when we talk to citizens about what we're trying to do with it and what we're accomplishing. A couple more examples: Lake McCarran Metropolitan Area Project, you know, has a grant that got us 39% of the way towards a goal for phosphorus for that particular water body. Here's a groundwater example in Wadena Soil and Water Conservation District. Here's a project that is doing two things. One, it's helping to reduce the demand on the groundwater withdrawal by 25 to 30%, but it's also because they're carefully timing the application of that irrigation water back onto the crop, they're able to reduce the amount of nitrogen that leaves, you know, or leaches or leaks down back into the groundwater. So you're both saving the groundwater consumption and you're also preventing it from becoming polluted by the nitrogen that might otherwise leak through, and you're saving the landowner money because their nitrogen is not going into the water, it's going into the plant, and so it's a win-win-win. Little Rock Lake, up Highway 10, here, you know, we've got a much more heavily developed lake. There's a stream flow going through it as well, and here, you know, this project is making an 11% increment step towards dealing with the phosphorus problems in that lake that's highly developed and needs some improvement, as you can see by the pictures. These Clean Water Fund projects, which I talked about here just in the last few slides, you know, they're all over the state. Some of them are restoration, some of them are protection, but we see these projects happening all over the state on private land. You notice not too many in the Rainy River watershed because, you know, most of that area is public land, and so there are a few. We don't have a lot of water quality problems there, but where we need to do some protection, those dollars are available for that as well. As I mentioned early on, and I'll repeat here, you know, our focus is really on the public, I'm sorry, the private lands. We have the private lands identified here in the gold shade. It's not too much of a coincidence that, you know, the impairments that we've identified, or MPCA has identified through their monitoring and assessments, have, you know, a large amount of private land in the watershed. You know, the forests and the public lands in the north largely have are full of, you know, wetlands and other water bodies that don't have that same water quality challenge. So this is the alignment between the private lands work and the public expectations for cleaner water. Just a few more things on the accomplishments. I'm not, these are just numbers, you know, they probably don't mean much, but these over time, you know, over, you know, decades, you know, these things do add up and they make a difference. And I'll just, Mr. Chairman, end it there with 5 minutes to spare.
Well, thank you, Director. I appreciate it. I've got a few folks here with questions. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jeske, I just have one question, believe it or not. It's on page 9. Of your slides.
Mm-hmm.
You've got permanent resource protection on this map, and I'm wondering, do you have the percentage of the land down there that is in this protection zones?
Director Jaskey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, they're referring to the rim easements, and I can get you the total acres. Off the top of my head, I'm going to estimate that it's somewhere around 280,000 acres total across the entire state. But let me make sure I get that number correct, and I'll get it back to you and share it with the committee administrator as well.
That would
Thank
be
you.
Good. Thank you. Representative Heinzman.
Mr. Chair, Director Jaskey, I just you had mentioned some protections for groundwater in the presentation, and I do want to say there's a lot of things that I am watching and seeing in your discussion here that I think is very beneficial to lakes and streams, so I don't want to make this sound like a criticism, but it's more of a question. I'm not sure, but I just wanted to get your perspective on something. I recently was, well, I shouldn't say recently, this is some time ago, but in the last year, attended a Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts annual meeting, and there was a workshop on groundwater, and of course there's a lot of discussion going forward as to what we're going to do with some of the issues we're facing and some of the nitrates and things we're seeing in groundwater. But something that caught my attention was, I'm not sure if it was even during the discussion or sometime after, was the comment that was made that the state spends a lot of money protecting groundwater and will continue to do that. And those folks with a private well aren't necessarily paying their fair share. And I think kind of the implication there is we might be moving towards some plans in the future to possibly regulate that, maybe somewhat like what we see in a in city limits context, or where you have city utilities and you're paying and you have a meter on that well. Is there a plan that you're aware of at any level to implement something like that in the future?
Director Jaffe. Yeah,
Mr. Chair, Representative Heisman, I'm not aware of any plan. The current requirements, and DNR can correct me if I misspeak, but you need a permit if you withdraw more than 10,000 gallons per day or a million gallons per year. So, you know, I don't, there's no normal household would be appropriating, you know, anywhere near those amounts. But, you know, at some point when you get into more industrial uses, of course, then you trigger those thresholds, and then a permit's required, and there are some fees that go with that permit for that usage.
Representative Heinzman, follow
thank
up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Director Jansky. So your understanding is there isn't necessarily any discussion right now that you know of in changing rules that would lower those thresholds to incorporate private wells in, say, a small farmer, landowner type situation, house and maybe outbuildings kind of thing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heisman, I'm not aware of any plan.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Executive Director Jaskey, a lot of conversations about buffers here in the last couple of weeks. On one of your slides, you transitioned from buffers to the Wetland Conservation Act. And I'm curious to know, what's the correlation between buffers, Wetland Conservation Act? What's the interaction? What is the relationship that exists between those two things? Is there something there that we can use moving forward?
Director Jaskey.
Mr. Chairman, off the top of my head, I would say that one common intersection is that they're both, you know, using local staff to implement the programs. I mean, their soil and water districts and counties are the primary agents for those programs, and so I think that's one common denominator. The other common denominators are that there are programs available to help landowners with a voluntary opportunity to restore a wetland or to install a buffer. So there are some programming on the voluntary side that can cover both of those. And easements are one of those tools that cross over in both of those areas.
Follow up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another topic, you also talk about drainage and the public and the drainage work group. Can you kind of run through quickly what is the role of that drainage work group?
Director Jaskey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, the drainage work group is, a statutory responsibility of our agency to, you know, to organize, you know, forums for multiple interests, drainage interests, ag interests, environmental interests, local government interests, and the agencies do that. Our chief engineer, Al Kane, is the one who leads that. They meet, you know, regularly. I know some legislators have been there, off and on. You know, Representative Hansen has been there probably the most, at least one. I don't get through every meeting either, but their objective has been to bring policy recommendations forward to the legislature. And, you know, also one of the key jobs they have right now is to oversee, along with the contracts and so forth, the development of the public drainage manual. So that's been their focus in the last year or two.
Director Jaskey, to that point, do they work also on private drainage, ones that aren't public authority?
Mr. Chairman, just a little bit will be my answer, because one of the things that's a little, you know, it's not entirely black and white, is that a public drainage system is a piece of infrastructure. It's a ditch or a big tile line. There are private drainage that goes into those areas that are within a benefited area, and they are paying for some of that. There's also private drainage that occurs, you know, outside of any public designated ditch system. And so they do a little bit, but mostly it's focused on the public systems.
Thank you. Representative Fabian, continue. Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jaskey, you referred to the 1991 Wetland Conservation Act. Simple. What is the definition of a wetland?
Director Jaskey, I am reminding you of the time. No. Director Jaskey.
Well, you know, it's the place where the land and the water meet, but it's really has to have three things, and there's a very scientific way to determine this. It has to have what's known as hydric soils, which shows evidence the soil's been saturated sufficiently and frequently enough. It would have hydrophytic vegetation, which is plants that are adapted to grow with their roots wet, and then it has to have water, which of course is, you know, sort of
evidenced by the other two. When it's real dry and when it's wet, of course, the water can even go beyond that wetland boundary. And so it has to have those three things, the water, the hydrophytic plants, and the hydric soil. I can give you more detail on through. There's methods to determine where that boundary begins and ends, and that's something that we've got a lot of effort in training and certification on.
And Director Jaski, to Representative Hancock's point, and Representative Hancock, you'll be able to continue. You have 1, 2, 3, and 4, and can you do the wetlands? Are they by class 1, 2, 3, 4, or type? I'm sorry, type 1, 2, 3, 4. Can you just say real quickly which one or four wetter, and what? How do we delineate?
Hi, Mr. Chairman and Representatives. There are several different classification systems. The one that you're referring to, Mr. Chairman, is the one that's been around the longest. It identifies wetlands as 8 different types, and one is the driest, 5 is the wettest. Okay, so you go from, you know, think of a confined basin, you know, one being just very infrequently water located there, and a type 5 would be almost like a lake or a very shallow lake. Then you have type 6s, which are they're called shrub scrub wetlands, which are willows and alder and things like that, where you got saturated soil, but you got, you know, small trees and things growing. You got the type 7, which are the floodplain forests where black ash and other species grow. And then you got type 8, which are the peat bogs that, of course, are floating, and then you've got tamaracks and things growing on them. So those are the 8 types. I can get you, Mr. Chairman, members that would like to see it, some brochures, some information to kind of distinguish what those look like as an example.
That might be good for us to have. Follow up, Representative Hancock.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Deske. I think all of us recognize the value of wetlands, and I'm not disputing that at all. I'm just saying in my district, we're also concerned with good farmland, and it seems like the wetland mitigation, we have a lot of wetland in the north and the northeast, and you mentioned that as a challenge. Has there been a study as to what the wetland mitigated lands and the banks have done to property tax base for the various counties?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hancock, no, we haven't. We've got some information, and I'll share it with you when I go back or get it and share it with you. We had some work done by the university to assess what the effect was on easements, which might be very similar to what you're describing about converting land back to what it once was. I'll share that with you and see if that's what you're looking for.
Thank you, Director. Thank you. Next is Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to go quick. Mr. Jaski, I want to go back to the disaster bill, and I had some questions yesterday about conservation practices, and we provided in the disaster bill, I think it was $2.3 million to your agency, and I think during the debate there was some discussion about there was $3 million of Bowser money taken from Duluth. So I'd like to know what happens to those projects that may have been online for completion in Duluth, and then is there a difference between the amount of money that we appropriated yesterday and what the requests were? I think, Mr. Chair, I asked about Dakota County, and if it seems to me, and I think Dakota County SWCD might still be in the room, but what were the requests from the disaster affected counties, and how does that compare to the actual appropriation yesterday?
Director Jaski, and if it's more than you can give in just a minute, I would like to have you get that information to the committee and we can distribute it. Director Jaski.
Yeah. I'll quickly, the money that was canceled for the Northeast flood was money that we no longer needed. We had gotten $6 million transferred to us, and we used $3 million, and so the $3 million was able to be canceled. We kept a $200,000 contingency for projects that are going to have overruns, but Duluth is still being worked on, but it is taken care of to make sure all the funding is there for their needs. And the question you asked about the current disaster, I can get you a spreadsheet that shows county by county reports that we've received of actual requests for damages that haven't yet been met, and I'll share that with the committee as a whole, and you can go from there.
Thank you, Director. And then last question, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jaski, just a quick question here. On page 12, you have a photograph of some soil erosion due to wind. Mm-hmm. I just had a quick question. when you have one farm property that's being eroded by wind, that's affecting another adjacent property, does Bowser, do you have any authority to, what is your role in that?
Director Jaskey.
Mr. Chair, members of Neuberger, no, there's no authority. The role that we have is to have the Soil and Water Conservation District, if they have resources and time, to go out and talk to that person about some options, including, you know, tillage practices primarily, or cover crops, things like that, that can be used to reduce wind erosion.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Jaskey. I appreciate you make it through. Members, I remind you, tomorrow we have the LaSalle Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council bill before us, and if anyone has amendments for that bill, they're due at 3 o'clock today. Members, we're adjourned.